We're happy to have Dwayne and Shirley here. Dwayne Hyde's been with Game and Fish forever. That's what it feels like sometimes, isn't it? And we're pleased that he's agreed to come and give us some history and information about the Fish and Game Department and some of the things, some of the experiences he's had. So we'll turn the time over to Dwayne.
Wildlife has played a major role in the settlement of the West, and it was the beaver that brought the explorers and the trappers into this country and first explored the country. It was a game that fed the trappers and the early pioneer settlers. It was a game that fed the railroad crews, and game meat was sold in most of the early eating establishments. I don't know that you'd call them cafes, but eating houses. Market hunting and subsistence hunting took a heavy toll of early wildlife populations. Lack of refrigeration meant that they had to kill meat very often. Without refrigeration, meat would spoil within a week, and so they killed a lot of game animals. Some of these early people developed some real innovative ways of preserving their meat, however. They'd hang it out at night and wrap it in their bedrolls at night. They would make ice houses or spring houses along creeks. They did whatever they could to keep the meat fresh as long as they could, but without refrigeration, they couldn't keep it very long. And so the result of that was that many of the wildlife populations were depleted so badly. By the early 1900s, very few strict law, or pardon me, by the early 1900s, the game was depleted so bad that they made strict laws to try to control the excessive harvest and maintain the populations that were left. It was about that time that they started hiring game wardens to enforce game laws and to protect the animals from over-harvest. I'd like to take each species by itself and give a little summary of the history of what's happened with that population in this area. Not much is known about early deer populations. Stories I've heard was that there probably was not very many deer in the area, and that what deer there were probably very heavily over-harvested by the early pioneers. And those early settlers in this country, they seemed like they were always short of rations, and a fresh deer or some other game animal carried them through until they had other provisions. My grandfather said that when he was a boy in Auburn, that most of the deer in the valley at that time were white-tailed deer. He said that they migrated north down the Snake River in the fall and wintered somewhere down in the Ryrie country and down around Idaho Falls. One winter, about the turn of the century, the deer went out that fall, and they had a very hard winter, and the deer didn't come back in the spring. And that was pretty much the end of the white-tailed population in this area. And as the deer rebuilt, they rebuilt more as a mule deer population. In fact, whitetails were pretty much non-existent in Star Valley for a number of years, although in the past 10 years or so, even maybe a little longer than that, 15 years, we've started to have more and more whitetails show up. This is kind of a trend throughout the West. Mule deer populations are struggling, and whitetail populations are filling in to some extent. My father claimed that when he was growing up in Auburn, there were very few deer. He said he was almost 30 years old, about 1934, when he killed his first deer. He and another fellow named Buck Daugherty found a deer track north of Auburn in the fresh snow, and they followed that track for 2 days and finally killed deer somewhere over in the Grover Park area near Turnerville. So if they would follow a deer track for 2 days, that would indicate to me that there weren't very many deer around. In the 1930s and 40s, predator populations were greatly reduced, and with the growing game warden force and the strict enforcement of game laws and limits, the deer population made a great comeback. By the late 1950s, we had a large deer population. This population continued to grow and to an all-time high in the late 50s and the early 60s. The herd had grown so large, it had outgrown its winter range. If you go out in the morning and look at the hills on the east side of town here and look at the evergreen trees, you'll see that even to this time, you can still see that the deer eat all of the low branches that they could eat, that they could reach. There's no evergreen branches within a deer's reach except some that have grown in very recent years, but all of the old trees are high-lined as high as a deer could reach at that time. During this time, farmers and ranchers stacked their hay out in the fields where it was cut. They would haul it to their livestock in the wintertime with a team and sled. The deer would get into these stacks and eat a lot of the hay that the farmers need to get their livestock through the winter. I remember as a teenage boy, old-time game wardens such as Archie Pendergraft, John Gutz, and Newell Gardner would go to the sawmills and buy slabs and deliver them to farmers so that they could build panels to put around their stacks to protect them from the deer. When I moved back here in 1971 and became the warden here, we were concerned that the deer herd was declining at that time, and we formed an action group to see if we could figure out a way to stabilize the deer herd. One of the things that we did was to plant a lot of bitterbrush in Spring Creek west of Fairview. These bitterbrush plants were supplied by the Forest Service, and they supplied the power augers that we used to dig the holes to plant the brush. Doug Hawes, Joe Kinsella, and Gary Fulmer were Forest Service people who helped us with that project. Some of the seasons they'd been having when I came back here was multiple deer seasons, three deer seasons, and their seasons ran clear into December. We got rid of the multiple deer seasons and shortened the seasons into November. In spite of our efforts, the deer population continued to decline, and in the winter of 84 and 85, which was very severe, a large part of the deer herd died that winter. That winter we had 11 days that were below 40 below in January. When temperatures are that low, a lot of the fawns just simply lay down and die of exposure. They cannot make it through the night when it's that cold. After that winter, we shortened the seasons again and did away with most of the doe harvest. The deer were slowly coming back, and in 1989, we got some new biologists that decided that we had too many deer. And 1,500 additional doe fawn permits were issued. In the following 3 years, seasons were increased to where a hunter could kill as many as 10 deer. The winter of 1992 and 93 again was a hard winter, and killed as much as 30% of the remaining deer. During this time, the mountain lion population was increasing, and the black bear seasons were reduced to the point that that black bear population was growing also. Predation was a deer population controlling problem. All of this combined with the loss of habitat due to people building next to the winter ranges has caused the deer population to decline, and at this time there is serious concern about the welfare of the deer herd. I talked to Dick Taylor the other day, excuse me, and it was interesting to me that the first year he had his camp In Swift Creek, they killed as many as 60 deer out of that one camp. That number compares very close to the number of deer that was brought through the Grays River check station this past fall out of all of Grays River. So that gives you an idea of where the deer herd, deer population is at this time. Excuse me just a second. We have a lot more reliable information about elk. But most of the earlier information we have relates to Jackson Hole. But it's reasonable to assume that whatever was going on in Jackson Hole, something very comparable was also going on here. And so I'm going to give you some information from Jackson Hole, including I want to read a little summary about their origin of the Jackson feed ground and a little bit of the information of the elk that are up there. In 1987, a hunter and a trapper who wintered in the Jackson Hole reported that 15,000 elk wintered in the valley and the surrounding area. The official Forest Service figures for 1912 and 1916 were estimated to be 13,000 elk wintering in that area during those winters. Figures for 1921 indicate that 9,000 elk wintered there that winter. By 1945, as many as 22,000 elk were wintering in Jackson Hole area, and this buildup was largely due to the winter feeding program that had been started there. The first elk feeding occurred in 1907 in Pinedale. I'm going to read you a little bit out of an article that was written by a fellow named Bob Brown. I don't know if any of you have heard of Bob Brown. I'm sure Judy has. Bob Brown was a warden in this area in the early 1940s, and he was flying a winter game count in Grays River with a forest ranger named Markham and the pilot of the airplane. And up in Moose Creek, they made a pass in there and crashed the plane. Bob was the only one of the three that wasn't killed. And he was able to crawl down Moose Creek, and he crossed the Grays River Road there by the mouth of Moose Creek and crawled on down by the river. Well, the next day, Sam Young came along, snowshoeing down the river, I think, to check his traps, or he may have been looking for Bob, I'm not sure. But anyway, he found the tracks, and he followed the tracks down to the river, and he couldn't move Bob, but he left him a sandwich. Bob was unconscious and laying there by the water. I got to know Bob Brown, and he said what he came to, there was that sandwich. And he said, damn, somebody's been here. So... He ate part of the sandwich and apparently passed out. But he did survive, and they found him. Sam got word out, and they rescued him with snow planes. They went up there with snow planes and got him out. Anyway, that's the story of Bob Brown, who wrote this article here. 1882, and this is a little bit of chronology about the elk herd in the Jackson area. In recent times, there's been a little bit of discussion about trying to reestablish an elk migration out of Jackson Hole down onto the desert there by Pinedale. And this starts out relating to that situation. Perhaps at one time the Wapiti did migrate from Jackson Hole region to the desert. This has not been established, and this article was written in 1947. There's every indication that at least some part of the elk herd made their seasonal treks from this area to the desert, but it is also probable that there has always been a distinct Jackson Hole herd that has spent the winter and the summer in this area. The herd that wintered in the desert was decimated by encroachment of civilization earlier than the herd which stayed in Jackson, since civilization's advance into the Jackson country was many years later. At least we have records of a disastrous winter in 1982, which was 2 years before the first settlers came into that region. 1984, the settlers came into Jackson Hole.
1884,
excuse me. Okay. 1886 to 88 was a winter of severe losses. 1899-91 was another. 1895 was largely to check activities of Indian hunting parties that the state in 1895 passed a $20 non-resident hunting license law to create the highest priced non-resident hunting license of the time in any of the western states. Sheriff John Ward of Uinta County arrested a Bannock Indian from Idaho for killing 7 elk in the Jackson Hole. This case was carried through the United States Supreme Court by Willis Vander, who represented the state of Wyoming. In its decision, which was in favor of the state, the court ruled that the treaty made by the United States with the Bannock Indians did not give them the right to exercise hunting privileges granted by the treaty within the limits of the state of Wyoming in violation of its laws. By 1903, the cost of non-resident license was raised to $50. At that time, the highest non-resident fee in the United States to discourage indiscriminate hunting by certain classes of hunters from other states. 1904, trouble with the tusk hunting hunters began. It was to continue for a number of years. 1905, the year of the Teton Game Preserve was established, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later. It was abolished by legislative action 42 years later in 1947. In 1906, D.C. Nallen suggested that Teton County Game Preserve be extended to include the Upper Grovant and to reach to the big bend of the Green River. That would be clear above Kendall there, but it would take in all that upper Grovant and all that upper Green River country. 1907, the first record of supplemental feeding. Notation is made that the warden near Pinedale was urged to provide feed for 200 snowbound elk on Willow Creek, with the supervisor of the Teton Forest making provision for the funds to purchase hay. 1909 to 1910, one of the most severe winter losses to date. Definite steps were taken to provide feed to wintering elk. $5,000 was provided by the Wyoming legislature for hay, but more than half of the herd perished before the coming of spring. 1910 and 11, the herd again suffered great losses, conservatively estimated at close to 2,500 elk, with 75% of the calves dead before spring. In 1911, on March 4th, in response to a memorial passed by the state legislature, Congress appropriated $20,000, which was made immediately available for feeding of elk and making a preliminary investigation as to the possible methods of relieving the situation or transferring some of the animals elsewhere. This is the first record we can find of proposed transfer of elk, and in 1912, 12 elk were captured and moved to the National Bison Range in Montana and to the Wichita National Game Range in Oklahoma. In 1912, on August 4th, 1912, Congress appropriated $45,000, and in early 1913, an additional $5,000 for the purchase of Jackson Hole lands for raising hay. With these funds, 1,760 acres of private land were purchased, and with the adjoining 1,040 acres of public land added by executive order, a total of 2,800 acres, made up the plot for which the National Elk Refuge was established. It was soon determined that the area was inadequate, however, and after all the efforts to obtain congressional action for this action of funds to enlarge the refuge, the Isaac Walton Lake, through public donation, purchased 1,760 acres adjacent to the refuge at a cost of $36,000. Congress accepted title in 1927 to what was to be known as the Isaac Walton addition to the Elk Refuge. In 1935, Congress, by appropriation, enlarged the refuge to its present acreage with the addition of 2,700 acres leased from Jackson Hole Preserve, which was Rockefeller lands. There is now 25,000 acres, pardon me, in the refuge, and that's the present size. In this area, the first elk feeding occurred at Sheep Creek in 1927 or 28. At that time, they built a couple of metal granaries there by the mouth of Sheep Creek, and they stored, I've heard of several different stories on that. There were probably some grain, probably some cottonseed cake, and some hay. Anyhow, people would snowshoe up to Sheep Creek once in a while, either a game and fish person or the Forest Service helped at that time, or if somebody else happened to be going up trapping or somebody was going by, they could put out feed for a couple of days. This trip took about 2 to 3 days each way. Sometimes they would go in from Alpine, and sometimes they'd go in from Smith's Fork. They would do their winter game counts as they came and went. They stayed at guard stations along the way. Although feeding was done with the best intentions, it probably did more harm than good, since it would concentrate the elk, and then when the feeder left, then the elk could hang around there for a few days and try to get into the granaries and try to steal a little more hay, and consequently they wouldn't disperse back out onto the winter range. About 1935, these sheds were moved to Dead Man Creek, and a cabin was built so a feeder could stay there for longer periods of time and feed on a more regular basis. Sometime in the 40s, these buildings were moved to the mouth of Little Grays, and the feeding was done there for a few years. In the late 1940s, the feeding was moved downstream to Gillis Flat, just east of Alpine, and shortly thereafter, with the acquisition of 1,400 acres at the present feed ground site just west of Alpine, the feed ground was moved to that site, where it's remained to this day. About 1905, as I mentioned in the article I was reading there a little bit ago, some game preserves were established, and I don't have a lot of information on them, but there was the Teton Game Preserve, and there was one called the Days River Game Preserve, and that was in Little Grays, and it included the land between Little Grays and Snake River, the Bradley Mountain country and that area up through there. I was curious about the designation of the Days River Game Preserve, and so I did some research on it to see what I could find out about that connotation. And I come up with some information on a book called Wyoming Stream Names, written by D. Linford, who was a brother to Corwin Linford. And in 1812, it was the John Hunt, Robert Stewart, Astorian party camped near the mouth of the Hoback River. And that's the setting for what I'm going to read here. On the origin of the name Grays River, largest tributary received by Snake River in Wyoming, the record is not so specific. Early maps identify the stream as John Day's River, commemorating another member of the Astorian party. The name was changed to Gray's in more recent years, possibly because of an objection by Crittenden. And Crittenden, as near as I could tell, was an early chronicler of strain names and documenting history of the country and so forth. And he did that in 1902. It is unfortunate that modern, and this is what he wrote, it was unfortunate that modern geography has made a mistake in perpetuating the name of this stream, John Day's. It should be John Gray. There was a John Gray in the Hudson Bay Company service under Alexander Ross and a person by that same name. But whether or not the same individual or not is uncertain in the American Fur Company service between 1830 and 1835. Both John Grays, if different individuals, were distinguished hunters, and from one of them came the name Gray's Hole, as applied to a valley on the stream which is now called John Day. And that doesn't add up because there's no valleys on the Gray's River, but there's a little more explanation of it here later. The hunter who bore the later name was never near this stream. However, Washington Irving, chronicle of Astor's costly venture on the Pacific coast, reports in Astoria, 1936, that Day was one of the three men sent by Hunt from the mouth of the Hoback River in 1811 to investigate the navigability of Snake River downstream. Further, Hunt's journal reports that the three set out downstream to explore it for a distance of 4 days' march. Since the extent between the mouths of the Hoback River and the Gray's or Day's River is hardly 25 miles, and since the explorers were gone for three of their allotted 4 days, it is likely that Day at this time was at least near, if not indeed not actually reached the mouth of the river which bore his name. Another chronicler, Rawlins, also reports that Day, who started east with Robert Stewart's returning historians, but went insane and was returned to the Astor Post, recovered despite Irving's statement to the contrary, and spent the remaining years of his life on the upper reaches of the Snake River Valley, but succumbed in 1820 in the Salmon River Mountains of Idaho. This goes on to explain how Gray's Lake started out as Day's Lake, and the town of Gray's Lake was called Day. Well, when they applied for their post office in 1880, the Postal Service wouldn't allow them to have the name Day because there was already another town by the name of Day in Idaho, and they didn't want to any confusion, so they had him call it Gray, and it the town and the lake eventually took the name of Gray's Lake. There's a little bit of information here on Salt River, and maybe I'll just read it too, as long as we're right here. So much for the riddle of John Day or John Gray or John Grey. And the river which now bears his name. Circumstances accounting for the designation of the last important tributary acquired by the Snake in Wyoming, the Salt River, are not so controversial. According to Granville Stewart, and this is another chronicler, the Snake Indians interchangeably called Salt River Tassa Carnell, meaning White Lodges, and taking note of a number of small white geyser-eyed cones left along its course by extinct mineral springs and Onabitipah, which he translated to mean salt water and which referred to the course of the salt ledges and the saline springs which occurred along its principal tributaries. Crow and Stump, or Stump, S-T-U-M-P-H, creeks. Tradition says that the Indians in prehistoric times traveled great distances to secure salt from deposits along these two streams, and Stump Creek bears the name of Emil Stump, S-T-U-M-P-H, who was a partner of a man named William White, and they operated a salt works in the 1860s along the stream, then known as Smoking Creek, for the mountains from which it heads. The partners hauled their refined products by ox team to mining camps in Idaho and Montana. Original application of the name Salt to this stream is not evident. Robert Stewart, and this is one of the historians who was camped at the mouth of the Hoback when the controversy over Grays River occurred, apparently followed the length of Star Valley while wandering lost through the area in 1812, refers to it only as another stream, but Irving retraced the routes of both Hunt and Stewart from their original journals some 20 years later, uses the name to designate the stream as probably the first appearance in literature. In the early 1970s, as we started using snowmobiles more and we started spending more time up Grays River, we become aware of what a hard time the elk that were wintering in Grays River were having. And so in 1972, we did a little study. There were 31 calves and a herd of 127 elk that started the winter in Forest Park. Before spring broke, every one of the calves were documented to have winter killed. This area was very popular with coyote hunters because there were always dead elk there, and there were always coyotes there feeding on the dead elk. Because of that information, in 1974, we made a proposal to the Wyoming Game Fish Commission to start an elk feed ground in this area. In 1980, the commission and the Forest Service finally gave approval to starting a feed ground here, and since that time, the 127 elk that were wintering there have grown to over 800. At the present time, our elk herd in Star Valley and the Grays River area is an excellent number, and the elk are doing very well.
Wayne.
Yes.
Our elk and deer population never will increase much now with all these wolves and that we like.
Well, they're definitely a factor. The elk, we're probably going to be able to maintain it at good levels because we take care of them on feed grounds where we don't have to worry about the loss of winter habitat and so forth. But the deer probably will never come back anywhere near what they were, but they could come back somewhat from what they are now. I think they could be quite a bit better than they are now. I don't have a whole lot of information on moose, but prior to the 1940s, it was unusual to see a moose in this area. Moose started to become more plentiful during the 40s, and by the late 40s, they'd opened the season for a few permits. Moose population continued to grow during the 50s and 60s, and permits were increased accordingly. When I moved back to Afton in 1971, they were issuing about 65 permits in all of Grays River and Salt River. Over the next 5 or 6 years, we increased the permits to 100. We held the permits at that level for a few years and began to see a decrease in the population. So about 1977, we began to slowly decrease the permits and eventually got back to about 80 permits in 1987. And at that time, the same two biologists that took care of our deer herd had some ideas about the moose herd, too, and they brought the moose permits back to 100 permits. And I told them at that time, I said, you don't have to make all these mistakes. I've already made them once. Since that time, the moose population has continued to decline, and at the present time, the moose population is very low. I don't know what it's going to take to turn the moose population around. In the last few years that I worked, there was quite a bit of disease in the herd, We often found dead animals in the summertime, and they're emaciated. They get weak and they get down, and they lay there for days just thrashing and too weak to get up, but they eventually die. I sent samples in from several of these moose, and the only thing that they ever sent me back was that it was probably conjunctivitis, and conjunctivitis is a lot like pneumonia. But it seems to me that there's something in the moose that's a lot more serious than conjunctivitis.
That's just red eyes.
Is that well, what they told me was it was a lot like pneumonia, a compilation of minor things, but several of minor things wrong with them. Grizzly bear. I think this is an appropriate time to talk about grizzly bear, since grizzly bear are becoming more plentiful in this area and the surrounding area. I want to read a little bit out of a book here, and I hope I'm not reading too much for you, but some of this stuff, I'm going to miss a lot of the points if I don't read the actual accounts. All of the early trappers and the people that came into this country were commonly having trouble with grizzly bears. Lewis and Clark, and many of their stories was about grizzly bears chasing their people into the river. And even though a lot of them didn't know how to swim, they'd jump in the river and hide under the bank to get away from the grizzly bears. So they were pretty scared of them if they'd jump in the Missouri River to get away from the grizzly bear. But anyway, they were common. This book here, Great Wyoming Bear Stories by Tom Reed. I became acquainted with Tom Reed this winter when I started to work with the Sportsman for the Wyoming Range, and he's the author of this book, and he sent me a copy of it during the winter. Perhaps the most famous of all trapper journals, and certainly the best written, is Osborne Russell's Journal of a Trapper. Russell traveled all over the West during the Mountain Man era, and he, like other young men, had encounters of his own with the great white bear. In the summer of 1835, Russell was with a party of 17 men trapping along the Bear River and one of its tributaries, the Thomas Fork, in extreme western Wyoming. And the Thomas Fork, is right out here on the south end. One day they saw a grizzly bear digging in a marsh near a large stand of willows. The bear, intent on his work, did not hear them coming. The mulatto approached within 100 yards and shot him through the left shoulder. He gave a hideous growl and sprang into the thicket. The mulatto said, "Let him go. He's a dangerous varmint." But Russell, then 21 years old, convinced the man to accompany him into the willows after the wounded bear. Both men slowly took to the bear's trouble with trails, with rifles cocked and ready. They walked together on edge when they heard a sullen growl about 10 feet from us, which was instantly followed by the spring of a bear towards us, his enormous jaws extended and his eyes flashing fire. Oh heavens, was ever anything so hideous? Both men ran. Russell's partner shot and missed, and Russell suddenly found himself hemmed in on three sides by an impassable quagmire. I was obliged to turn about and face him. He came within about 10 paces of me, then suddenly stopped and raised his ponderous body erect. Russell pulled the trigger and luckily shot the bear right through the heart. He gave one bound for me and uttered a deathly howl and fell dead. But I trembled as if I had an ague fit for half an hour after. Maybe Dr. Perks can tell us what ague is.
Ague is a common term for chills and fever.
Okay.
Like consumption. In the old days, consumption just meant some form of lung disease.
Uh-huh.
Bright's disease was all kidney diseases. Ague was anything that caused aches and pains and fever.
Okay.
And chills.
Russell then made a vow never to molest another wounded grizzly bear in a more sure thicket.
Wise decision.
Prior to the white man area, Indians for the most part left grizzly bears alone unless they could attack them with a large force. But when whites set foot in grizzly bear country, everything changed. The mountain men nearly always attacked. A bear hide would bring $4, and grizzly claws were a tremendous status symbol. Those bears that survived likely learned that humans posed a new threat, but sometimes the bear took a toll of its own. In the summer of 1834, and this is the year before Osborne Russell had his experience, a 25-year-old Zinnius Leonard was a member of a trapping party that probed the valley of the Smith's Fork of the Bear River, and that here again would be just out on the south end and going south in western Wyoming. The force was moving along up the drainage when they saw a large grizzly bear lying in the shade at the edge of some woods. Four men, including Leonard, started for the bear to kill it, but the bear heard them and disappeared into a stand of trees. The party split up, intending to surround the bear and chase him and have some sport, but one of the men foolishly dismounted and followed the buffalo path into the brush. The grizzly was spooked towards the man, and though the man tried to climb a tree, the bear pulled him down by the leg and tore the tendon of his thigh in the most shocking manner. Before we could go to his aid, the bear made off and finally escaped. The party camped there for the night and tried to tend the wounded man as best they could, but he bled to death. So bears were very common in this area. I think it's interesting that generally people, when they came into this country, felt that they couldn't live with the grizzly bear, and they pretty much exterminated them. Here again, that makes you wonder if we have to keep reinventing the wheel. I'm afraid we're going to discover the same thing again. Antelope were very plentiful when the early settlers come through Wyoming, and it was very convenient for the travelers to go out and kill an antelope for supper. And they took a terrible toll on the antelope, and by the early 1900s, there weren't many antelope left. Also, antelope meat was the first game animals to prime up in the summer. They or out in the desert where it greens up early in the spring, and so they're on green feed earlier than a lot of the other game animals. Anyway, they're usually primed by mid-July, and so the earliest people like to kill antelope early in the summer, and then they'd kill the other game later on or whatever was convenient for them to kill. Anyway, by the early 1900s, they had depleted most of the antelope, and most of the hunting was stopped by 1920. After they stopped hunting the antelope, they made a great comeback, and by the late 1940s, seasons were reopened. And antelope have done great ever since they put the tighter controls on them. And at this time, we have a good number of antelope in all of our desert country.
Dwayne?
Yes.
I think there's quite a few out to Coakville, isn't there?
Yes. Yeah, and the Coakville herd is a herd that's has been growing probably a little more than some of the other more eastern herds. Beaver went through about the same thing as the antelope did. They were, of course, were the reason that the early trappers came into this country, and they hunted them very heavily. And
they ate them too.
Beaver tail stew was a delicacy.
But you never ate a beaver out of the Malad River. That's how Malad got its name, malady. Because if you ate a beaver out of the Malad River, you got sick. But most people don't know that the trappers ate beaver. But they did.
Yeah, they did. Beaver tail stew was a common dish, and another animal that they eat a lot was mountain lion. And they considered mountain lion a delicacy. And if you look at mountain lion meat, it's nice white meat like chicken meat. But you gotta get it in your head that it's good before you can enjoy it.
In fact, I'm wondering if they don't have the bigger.
Yeah, that's the way I tried to eat some rattlesnake one time, and it was really delicious, actually, but I no matter how much I chewed it, I couldn't swallow it. I finally had to get rid of it. Yes?
Speaking of mountain lions, my aunts who lived in the valley down at Etna, they said that one of the big problems they had is that as they came up through the Narrows area, but they would hear the mountain lions howling, and it would frighten them really well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they journeyed up through what's now the dump area and came that way to get, and then over the hill from Willow Creek on, in order to get up to Afton.
Mm-hmm.
And but they said that they really got scared when they came through that area because of the mountain lions.
Yeah, I think mountain lions used to have almost as bad a reputation as the wolves did, and of course the wolves have always packed a bad reputation.
Why don't the game and fish get rid of more of these mountain lions? They eat 50 deer a year, and there's one up the dam been up there eating a deer there last winter. How come the game and fish don't kill more of them?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know I have the answer to it. You know, mountain lions, for one thing, are very hard to get any kind of population estimates on, and they adjust the season according to how easily the quotas fell the previous year and how many females have been killed, and there's some criteria they use. But I agree with you. I think now that when the deer population is so low that mountain lion population should be greatly curtailed. And I'm a great appreciator of mountain lions too. I've hunted mountain lions most of my life and really enjoy mountain lions, but I'm afraid that at this time we can't have both, and I think that the deer are probably more important right now.
Well, why don't you tell us an experience or two you've had out with your dogs, haven't you? Getting them?
Yeah, but then a lot of guys have too, Glade. You know, yeah. There's a lot of lion hunters around anymore. So mm-hmm. They know very well that mountain lions are plentiful, so it's... Well, I don't have a whole lot of more information. Does anybody have any questions about anything?
I have
Todd?
One. I know that when we get old, why we keep thinking that things aren't like they used to be.
Right.
But as I recall, why there was a lot more rank antler blue elk on the alpine feed ground. This winter, when I went by and looked at it, it seemed like there were so few. Am I remembering right or not?
Well, I think you probably are to a degree, but I will say this about it. Depending on how hard the winter is, will determine how many of the male elk come in. It seems like the cows will always come in. The first time it clouds up, the cows will head for the feed grounds, but the bulls will hang back more until they're forced to come in. And so the severity of the winter will control to some degree bull-cow ratio on the feed ground that winter. The Forest Park feed ground normally runs a lot higher with bulls than the one at Alpine does, and part of the reason that the Alpine feed ground is down is the elk in the lower part of the river are hunted more heavily than the elk in the upper part. Not necessarily because the seasons are more liberal down here, but people like to hunt down here. They've hunted down there historically. They know the country. They know where they want to hunt and so forth, and that's where they go.
Wayne?
Yes?
I'd like to say a little bit about my acquaintance with this
one particular biologist that you mentioned. At one time, I was quite well acquainted with him, and I did a lot of writing and documentation and so on and so forth, and we'd go on extended trips, and we'd see a given number of game, and when we'd get back to town, and he would be telling his observations in the coffee shop and all, it turned into a whole new event for me. In fact, I got two trips for one, because it was nothing like what we actually see.
Well, fortunately, the person you're talking about doesn't work for the Game and Fish anymore, but there are still a couple of them left. Ramon?
I recall when I was going to high school, I'd go duck hunting, and the stubble was just full of ducks. You could just take a shot out of the air and get four or five. And that's just remembrance.
I think it's interesting to note that as the goose population increased during the 70s, the duck population decreased, and I think the same thing's true with elk and moose, or pardon me, with deer and elk. As the elk population increased, the deer population decreased. I think there's competition between the two species, and the larger, more dominant species will usually displace the smaller species to some extent.
Dwayne, how do you feel about this reintroduction of wolves?
Well, I think that if people could have lived with wolves and grizzly bears years ago, that they probably wouldn't have eliminated them at that time, and I don't think that's changed. I think there's still an aggressive species that's going to be a problem for people wherever the two intermix. Doctor?
I got a guy that buys bulls from me that lost 32 calves to wolves last year. 32. Nobody pays him for those calves.
Is he from Cody?
Dubois.
Dubois, okay.
How come he didn't get paid for them?
Government doesn't pay for them.
Well, they do.
They do.
If they document the fact that it was killed by a wolf, they normally do, and it seems strange to me that he didn't get any reimbursement, that my son Dave spent 3 years documenting kills like that, and that's all he did in the summertime. He'd just go around wherever a rancher complained and document whether the animal was killed by a mountain lion, a grizzly bear, or wolves. Paul?
Talking to Steve Clark earlier,
up Forest Park.
Don't know why. I guess they just didn't come over the mountain.
Yeah, that's probably it. They were probably on the Pinedale or Daniel's side over there, but they have been there previous years. And they haven't ever really been a big problem on Forest Park, but they have been in the area there at times. We have had mountain lions on the Forest Park feed ground 2 times. We've caught mountain lions and moved them from there. It was interesting. Dick, excuse me, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, this deer population, when they started poisoning coyotes about 1080, it really wiped out a lot of the coyotes.
Yep.
And I think the deer made a comeback at that time.
I couldn't agree with you more. In the late 40s, early 50s, and they really started doing a lot of heavy predator control, and the deer population just exploded.
Do you think, Wayne, that that's what happened, that pack of wolves that was up the river?
Not legally,
but...
Well, some of those were legally removed, yes, over near Daniel.
Somebody put some poison out of it?
Yeah, from what I heard, Everett, they mostly got town dogs.
I think they might have got a wolf or two, too.
It's a possibility that they did, you know, and they wouldn't have found the wolf, but they did find the town dogs because they tried to go home when they got sick. Shirley?
Quite a few years ago, when I was married to my first husband, his father
for the mink rancher. And there were quite a few guys up, I think it was a pen cup. He was trapping beaver.
Mm-hmm.
And so Grandpa asked me and I if we'd got a fancy for carcasses for him to feed to the mink. And anyway, we got up there and I saw these lines, all these little ground ball things hanging up all over. I said, what are those? And they said, that's what they used to make perfume with. I said, yeah. But you know, that really was. And
yes.
They have what they call musk perfume. It's my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
And if I know.
Yeah, that's some of the highest price perfume there is what's made from beaver castors.
Yeah.
Yep. Elma?
What about the automobile killing the deer?
Well, really hasn't been that big a problem as our deer population is depleted, but when the deer population does come back, you know, that is, they've taken a large number of deer. I've been through the area around Sage Junction there two or three times this spring, and occasionally you see a deer there, but you know, it used to be you'd see half a dozen every time you went through there, but there's just a few now. But that represents the fact that there's just not that many deer along through the area like there used to be.
The same thing is true up in the Osmond area.
Right there by the mouth of Dry Creek.
There's herds of them in there. Mm-hmm. And there are a few on the hills east of Grafton.
Yep.
The mountain lions are getting so many of them, they're just not growing the population like they were. Well, out in Cokeville area, used to see hundreds of them on the sides,
mm-hmm.
possibly herds of 100, and then farther out south of Cokeville, there were a lot of them. This is in the early 80s or
yeah. Well, it's going to be interesting to see what they can bring the deer herd back to, but it's in serious problem right now, and not just here. Throughout the Intermountain West, the mule deer population is down. About the time that I retired, there was even some talk of putting them on the endangered species list, and that didn't go anywhere, fortunately, but it does represent the fact that it's a concern over a large area. Carl?
Are there diseases within the deer population around here like there are down in Zion Park?
This chronic wasting disease that's been showing up more lately, and some of these diseases you don't know hardly what to think about them, whether they're that more prevalent now than what they have been, or whether our techniques are just improving to where we detect those things more often. But anyway, the chronic wasting seems to be getting more prevalent, but not here, more in the warmer areas on the eastern side of the state, near Cheyenne, in fact, all the way up through the eastern side, that's in the whitetails up around Newcastle and Sundance. Yeah. Yes?
How far west is the chronic wasting in the elk come in Wyoming?
Boy, I don't have any information on that. I just haven't heard anything.
It's in the Madison Bow Range, back around Laramie and Cheyenne.
Yeah. Most of that's happened since I retired 5 years ago, and I just haven't stayed current on it, so I'm not sure what the deal is on that.
I'm wondering if that moose disease was a chronic form of chronic wasting.
Boy, it sure looks like chronic wasting, but that was never what they diagnosed it as. So.
It took them years and years to diagnose them in deer.
Yeah. But yeah, it's very similar to what I've heard that chronic wasting does. They lose control and go down, and then they just lay there and thrash and suffer until they die. Gary?
Is there any program about coyote control that's Game and Fish are thinking of?
The Game and Fish probably will never get involved in coyote control. You know, the sheep ranchers have a pretty active program in that regard, and I take it back about the Game and Fish. They do contribute to that. So that is their avenue of participation, too.
I don't think that the deer are going to come back unless something's done with the coyotes. Just
That's, there are just a lot of things like that, Gary, that need to be addressed.
Mountain lions.
And a concern I have is the increase in bear population. You know, we killed 7 bear out of Dry Creek the last year that I worked, and if they were able to kill 7 bear out of one drainage, to me that tells me that there's an awful lot of bear around here.
Are they reintroducing grizzly bears from Yellowstone down this area?
To my knowledge, there's never been a grizzly bear brought into Grays River. There was a bear in Grays River in 2002, and he got in Fred Roberts' sheep. We sent a guy in there with hounds thinking it was a black bear, and he chased the bear off into a little blind bowl where the bear holed up in a thicket, and when the guy came in there with his hounds, the bear attacked him and he shot it and killed it. To my knowledge, that's the only documented grizzly bear that's been in Grays River during my tenure here.
Fred Roberts has 16,000 sheep.
It seemed like every summer or two we'd have grizzly bear sightings reported, and I don't discount those. You know, young bears, 2 or 3 year old males, are displaced from their mothers when they leave their mothers and go looking for a home range. I think they commonly come through this country looking for an area that suits them, but for some reason Grays River doesn't suit grizzly bears, and hopefully it never will to any large degree. So I'm sure there's been a number of grizzly bears go through Grays River and it just didn't suit.
What causes the chronic wasting disease in animals here? I know what they thought that it was happening over Europe, but what is happening here?
The way I understand it, Nan, is that chronic wasting is a historical disease and it comes and goes. I don't know if Dr. Perks has any more information on that or not, but that's my understanding, that it always has been here to some degree, but it is becoming more prevalent for one reason or another. Will, I thank you all, and I guess we'll wrap it up with that.
Thank you, Duane.